of his empire and were causing unending troubles. The initial threat came from the Slavs, tribes that were moving south and west towards the eastern Roman borders. The Slavs came from north of the Danube, but they weren't Germanic, a name that the Romans had applied indiscriminately to anyone from the northern territories. Imprecise though the term was, the Germanic peoples had spoken languages with a common source, which linguists have reconstructed in the form of Proto-Germanic, a hypothetical ancestral tongue. This suggests some sort of shared origin, too far back in time to be located with any certainty, but more than likely the far distant origin of the Germanic peoples was northern European. The Slavic tribes came from farther east, between the Vistula and Dnieper rivers, and belonged to a different language family. Author's note: contemporary historians called the Slavs Getae, because they first appeared in the territory where the ancient Getae had once lived. It isn't always easy to figure out exactly which tribes referred to by ancient historians belong to the Slavic rather than the Germanic language group, but both Jordanes and Procopius describe peoples, who seem to be Slavs, coming from the Carpathian Mountains, north of the Danube. They were taking up residence in the Danube River Valley, and threatening to overflow down into the old Roman provinces of Thracia and Illyricum. Author's note: the original homeland of the Slavs is an academic issue, which, like many having to do with ethnicity, is also political in nature. Anastasius dealt with the problem by exiling the Isaurians, who had shown a tendency to rebel, from their homeland, and settling them instead in Thracia. This had the double effect of weakening their sense of national identity and providing him with a barrier against the Slavs. To survive in their new country, the Isaurians had to fight off the Slavs. The Slavic invasion was joined by yet another influx of wanderers, the Bulgars. They were from Central Asia, from the same land as the Huns, and they were governed by Khans. The bulk of the Bulgar tribes, not yet coalesced into any kind of a kingdom, were still east of the Slavs, but trailing after them to the west. The later Russian Primary Chronicle says that they followed the Slavs into their territory and oppressed them there. They crossed the Danube in 499, fought, raided, and then returned back over the river, gorged with plunder and crowned with the glory of a victory over a Roman army. They invaded again in 502, stealing and destroying. The Eastern Roman domain was shrinking, not drastically or all at once, but a little at a time. The Persians had chipped away at the eastern border. To the west, invasions of Bulgars and Slavs into Thracia were growing more persistent, so in 512, Anastasius decided to build a wall against them. Wall building against barbarians was an old and honorable solution. Hadrian's Wall in Britain was only one of many erected in an attempt to keep invaders out, but the building of a wall was also an admission of defeat. It divided land into civilized and uncivilized, Roman and barbarian, controlled and uncontrolled, and Anastasius's wall, the Long Wall, gave Thracia away. It was 50 miles long and stood 30 miles west of the city. "It reaches from one shore to the other like a strait," wrote the 6th century historian Evagrius, making the city of Constantinople an island instead of a peninsula. The Long Wall saved Constantinople, but it temporarily reduced the Roman holdings west of Asia Minor to the capital itself and the land immediately around it. Despite the lingering threat of Persian attack, this reoriented the entire empire towards the east, away from the west. From this point on, with Italy lost to Theodoric and his Ostrogoths, the remnants of the Western Empire gone beyond recovery, growing hostility between the Bishop of Rome and the Bishop of Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire began its transformation into something slightly different. Byzantium, an empire that was less Roman than Eastern, less Latin than Greek, and increasingly less Catholic in the eyes of the Bishop of Rome. Author's note: I have chosen to use Byzantium, rather than Byzantine Empire, to refer to the eastern half of the old Roman Empire. So far as we know, the term Byzantine Empire is a later name, not used by the residents of Byzantium themselves. Ironically, while Anastasius was building the Long Wall to protect his empire from barbarians on the outside, barbarism on the inside of the wall became a much greater threat. Since the time of Constantine, the traditional Roman sport of gladiatorial combat had been systematically replaced by chariot racing, which was not as closely associated with worship of the old Roman gods. In the larger cities of the Eastern Empire, chariot racing dominated the sports and entertainment scene, like stock car racing in Charlotte, North Carolina, or football, soccer, in Manchester, England. It was a citywide phenomenon, part of the background of daily life, even for citizens who weren't particularly involved in it. Everyone in a city the size of Constantinople knew who the star chariot drivers were. Everyone had at least a passing acquaintance with the race results. And a good percentage of the city's inhabitants identified themselves, however loosely, with one of the chariot racing teams. These teams were not defined by individual drivers and their horses. Different associations and companies in the city sponsored the races, paying for horses and equipment, and each one of these sponsors used as its symbol a color: red, white, blue, green. A number of different horse and driver pairs might race under the color blue, and spectators of the races became fans, not of individual performers, but of the color under which they raced. The blues were one group of fans, the whites another, and like modern boosters, these fans, largely young men, were fanatical in their devotion to their color. They also hated each other with a zeal that scholars have tried to explain by finding deeper reasons for the hostility. Perhaps the reds were aristocrats, and the whites were merchants. Maybe the greens were inclined to Chalcedonian Christianity, while the blues preferred the heresies of monophysitism. None of these explanations really hold up. The fans hated each other irrationally, like hockey fans who beat each other senseless at half-time. By the time Anastasius died of old age in 518, the fans had settled into two opposed factions: the blues, who had absorbed the reds, and the greens, who now encompassed the whites. They were increasingly violent, always ready to seize any excuse to murder fans in the other faction. In fact, 3,000 blues had been killed at Constantinople in a 501 riot over chariot race results, and other riots in 507 and 515 had been almost as bloody. Anastasius left no son, although he had nephews who were anxious to claim the right to rule. In their place, though, the imperial bodyguard elected its own commander, the 70-year-old career army officer Justin, as the new emperor. Justin was shrewd, experienced, and had the support of the blues. He also had the firm support of his nephew Justinian, a soldier who was in his 30s. In 521, Justin made his nephew consul, the highest official position in Constantinople below that of emperor, and Justinian began to take a greater and greater part in the government of the empire. He was a competent administrator and an accomplished military leader, but he was also an ardent blues fanatic who did little to quell the growing violence of the racing fans in the city. Their excesses grew worse and worse. "They carried weapons at night quite openly," writes Procopius, "while in the daytime they concealed short, two-edged swords along their thighs under their cloaks. They used to collect in gangs at nightfall and rob members of the upper class in the whole forum or in narrow lanes. The people of Constantinople quit wearing gold belts or jewelry, since this was an open invitation to be mugged by a gang of blues or greens. They hurried home at sunset so they could be off the street before dark. It was a state of affairs that would persist for the next 15 years, before breaking out into open conflagration." Chapter 23. Aspirations. Between 471 and 527, the Bay Way of the North expand to the south, while Gorgoriao continues its conquests, and Sylla moves carefully towards nationhood. The Bay Way in the north of China was strong and warlike, the Liu Song in the south fading. Despite the imbalance, the two kingdoms had sworn a temporary truce. They had spent more time fighting over boundaries than figuring out how to strengthen their own states, and both needed to pay attention to neglected domestic matters. "Our ruling ancestors have worked hard to reign," the Bei Wei emperor, Wei Zhaowen, remarked, "but to establish an internal norm was an uphill task." Wei Zhaowen was the great-great-grandson of the Taoist emperor Wei Taiwu, who had died barely 20 years before Wei Xiaowen's coronation, an oddity produced by the fact that each of Wei Taiwu's successors had begun fathering sons at the age of 13 or 14. Wei Xiaowen himself was crowned in 471 at the age of 4. At first he was under the control of his grandmother and regent, the Dowager Empress Feng, a woman who only had power because she had managed to defy the traditions of the Bei Wei. The ancient custom of the nomadic Tuoba clan, the not-so-distant ancestors of the Bei Wei royal family, decreed that the mother of each crown prince be put to death so that she could not influence the politics of the court. Feng, who was Chinese by blood, had maneuvered her way out of execution. She then exercised her considerable energy and ingenuity in order to gain as much power as possible, inadvertently proving the point of the bloodthirsty Beiwei custom. As her grandson grew, the two managed to work out a power-sharing arrangement that turned them into co-rulers. Together, they began to transform the Beiwei court into a place that drew more and more from the Chinese heritage of the Empress Feng, and more shunned the traditions of the Xianbei nomads who had originally formed the kingdom. Chinese officials gained high places in the government. No one was allowed to wear the traditional nomadic dress of the Xianbei. The two even outlawed any use of the Xianbei language, decreeing that only Chinese could be spoken, and forced the great families to adopt Chinese surnames in place of their traditional clan names. Taoism remained a strong thread in the tapestry of northern Chinese religion. In fact, the peculiarly magical form of Taoism practiced by Wei Xiaowen's great-great-grandfather focused as it was on the preparing of elixirs. Wei Xiaowen himself had a court alchemist who spent many years trying to make the emperor a potion for immortality, was the bedrock on which medieval Chinese advances in pharmaceutical and chemical formulations were built. But Confucianism and Buddhism provided the Beiwei throne with much more useful tools for rule. As it had for centuries in China, Confucianism supplied a model for a state hierarchy. It provided a picture of the world in which properly ordered, properly structured government was an essential part of an orderly and moral universe. Buddhism offered something else entirely, a model for kingship. The Buddhism of northern China was Mahayana Buddhism, which, in contrast to the Theravada Buddhism of India and southern Asia, had developed a whole series of deities, each exercising a kind of king-like power. These deities were not quite a pantheon. Rather, each one of them was Buddha in a different manifestation. These manifestations were called bodhisattvas. They were enlightened ones who had reached nirvana and release from the cycle of rebirth and suffering, but who had chosen to turn back and remain in the world, refusing to depart into nirvana until all were saved. This was a departure from the intensely individual focus of Theravada Buddhism. Instead of simply honoring those who withdrew into solitude, Mahayana Buddhism praised those greater and more accomplished believers who worked on behalf of the less powerful. The bodhisattvas were the very models of kindly kings, and the Buddhism of the Beiwei gave the emperor the power of ideology, the sanction of an entire system of doctrine to undergird his claim to extend a wise and benevolent rule over his people. Wei Xiaowen and his grandmother built lavish Buddhist temples, provided land and money, and stamped the imperial sanction firmly on the religion by commissioning enormous Buddhist sculptures to be carved right into the soaring cliffs near the northern Beiwei capital of Pingcheng. Under their patronage, scores of Buddhist monks migrated from the south and west into the Beiwei kingdom, and Buddhist monasteries sprang up all through the country. One of the most famous of these, the Shaolin Monastery on the sacred mountain Songshan, was established by the Indian monk Batuo. The monks of the monastery were bound, by the terms of their royal endowment, to pray for the emperor and for the peace of the Beiwei people. As part of their prayer and meditation, the monks followed a set of physical exercises intended to focus the mind. According to legend, Beiwei generals who visited the monastery saw the monks carrying out their exercises, recognized the value of the systematic movements for fighting, and adopted them. These movements are considered the source for the martial art of Kung Fu. In 490, the Dowager Duchess died, leaving Wei Xiaowen, at 23, in sole power. He observed 3 full years of mourning for her, the traditional period of grief for a mother, not a grandmother, who typically got 27 days. With the mourning over, he rounded up the clan leaders of the Beiwei, now doubling as court aristocrats with Chinese names, and led them on what he claimed would be a military reconnaissance into southern China. Instead, he halted the army at the ruins of Luoyang, the old Jin capital that had been starved and sacked into submission in 311. Pingcheng, he told his men, is a place from which to wage war, not one from which civilized rule can come. Luoyang, 500 miles farther to the south, was the pinnacle of his plan to turn the Beiwei into a fully Chinese kingdom. He intended to rebuild it and to move the entire government from the old capital of Pingcheng. And he planned to recarve the giant Buddhist sculptures on 2 cliffs overlooking the river that ran through Luoyang, so that the divine eyes would still be watching the new capital city. The rebuilding took 9 years, and Wei Xiaowen did not live to see it finished. He died of illness in 499 at the age of 32, and was succeeded by his 16-year-old son, Wei Xuan Wu. At its peak, the reconstructed city was home to over 500,000 people, with walls 80 feet thick protecting them and 500 Buddhist monasteries inside. Only Chinese was spoken inside, and the Chinese classics had been gathered into a great city library for the education of the future officials of the Bei Wei. The ex-barbarians were coming closer and closer to eclipsing the glories of the Jin. To the east, the little Korean kingdom of Baekje, worried about the swelling size and power of Goguryeo to its north, sent an appeal to the Bei Wei court, asking for protection and alliance. The great Goguryeon king, Gungaito the Expander, had been followed by his son, Jiangsu, who ruled for 79 years and earned himself the epithet the Long-Lived. For decades, Jiangsu had been carefully transforming Goguryeo from a collection of conquered territories into a state. 20 years into his rule, he moved his capital city. His father had ruled from the ancient capital city of Gukne-song on the Yalu River. It was a good and defensible place for a fortress, but with Goguryeo's territory expanded so far down the peninsula, Gukne-song was now too far north to act as a center of government. Jiangsu decided instead to rule from Pyongyang, farther south, on the broad plains of the Taidong River. This suggested a new focus on the south, and alarmed the two southern kingdoms of Silla and Baekje. Both realized that help would have to come from the northern Bei Wei. The Liu Song were no longer powerful enough to tip the balance of power. Bei Wei armies were dispatched to help Baekje out, and Silla allied with its neighbor as well. But even this triple defense proved inadequate. In 475, King Jiangsu of Goguryeo led his armies against the capital city of Baekje. He captured the king of Baekje in battle and beheaded him, and the remaining Baekje government was forced south to the city of Ungjin. Baekje had almost been destroyed by the conflict. Meanwhile, Goguryeo had expanded its borders to cover a massive territory stretching far up to the north and even over to the west. But despite the ruination of its neighbor and ally, Silla survived. In part, this was because Goguryeo saw Baekje as a threat and Silla as an afterthought. Silla had lagged behind the other two states. In 500, when the Sillan ruler, Qi Jung, came to its throne, Silla still had little industry, almost no foreign trade, rudimentary administration. So unformed was its sense of nationhood that the country did not even have a single accepted name. Qi Jung became the catalyst for Silla's awakening as a nation. He took, for the first time, the Chinese title of king, Wang, instead of the traditional title of Maripkan, which was closer to governing noble. He began to outlaw some of the more ancient and unpleasant Sillan customs, such as burying slaves along with their masters. He brought Chinese consultants in to teach the people of Silla how to plough with oxen, something they had never done, and to demonstrate how to construct an underground ice cellar to preserve food in the hot summer months. Like the king of Bei Wei, the monarch of Silla saw Chinese government, Chinese technology, even Chinese dress and Chinese names as the keys to strength. With Chinese customs as his tool, he shaped Silla into a nation. His mythical stature as the father of Silla is preserved in the tales about him, which explains that Qi Jung had trouble finding a wife because his penis measured 17 inches long. Qi Jung's successor, King Po Feng, came to the throne in 514. Under his direction, Silla's government solidified into a true centralized state with a written code of law, published in 520, and a state religion. It was also during King Po Feng's rule that Buddhism finally came to Silla. Baekje and Goguryeo had been Buddhist for over 100 years, but in 527, Silla was still unconverted. In that year, the Indian monk Ado arrived in the capital city just in time to help the king of Silla out of an embarrassing dilemma. According to the traditional accounts, Haidong Kosungchon, the king of the Liu Song in southern China, had sent an ambassador to Silla bringing gifts of incense, but neither the king nor his court knew what the incense was, or how to interpret the gift. Ado, who was present in the court, explained that you were supposed to burn it, upon which the Chinese envoy bowed to him and said, "So monks are not strangers in this country after all." Immediately, the story adds, King Po Feng issued a decree permitting the propagation of Buddhism. Not long afterwards, Po Feng went a step further and declared Buddhism to be the state religion. The story reveals, with unusual openness, a court full of barbarians who know their own shortcomings and are saved from humiliation in front of the infinitely more sophisticated Chinese ambassador. The only way to prevent further humiliation was to become even more Chinese. Before long, the people of Silla had developed their own version of the past. Yes, Buddhism had come to Silla late, but Po Feng claimed that royal builders, while excavating for new foundations, had uncovered Buddhist stupas from long ago, and more. Pillar bases, stone niches, and steps remain of an ancient Buddhist monastery. He was refashioning the tale of Silla's past. Buddhism had been part of its history for centuries, even longer than it had been part of the history of the neighboring kingdoms. With a mythical past behind it, Silla was ready to give Goguryeo a run for control of the peninsula. Chapter 24. Resentment. Between 479 and 534, the Liu Song collapses in the south, and the Bei Wei splits apart in the north. While the kingdoms to the north and west raided the ancient Chinese traditions for themselves, the Liu Song were falling apart. The undignified Emperor Song Xiaowu, who had abandoned the principles of Confucian order in favor of pleasure and idleness, had been succeeded by Song Ming, who was nicknamed the Pig. After 7 years, Song Ming was followed by Song Haofei, an undisciplined teenager who ruled only 3 years before his antics, painting a target on the stomach of a dozing official and then shooting blunt arrows at it, became unendurable. The court officials assassinated him and instead elevated his 13-year-old brother, Song Shun. 2 years later, in 479, an exasperated aristocrat took the throne by force and declared himself to be Qi Gaudi, first emperor of a new dynasty. The Liu Song dynasty was finished. The Southern Qi dynasty had arrived. However, the Southern Qi dynasty turned out to be little more than a family grasping at the distant possibility of power. Qi Gaudi, elderly when he came to the throne, died within 3 years and passed his throne to his son, Qi Wudi. Qi Wudi kept power for 10 years, but at his death, a family free-for-all ensued. Eventually, Qi Wudi's brother seized power as Qi Mingdi in 494. He ruled for only 4 years, and then died, or, as a later historian put it, was compelled to drop the scepter which he had grasped through bloodshed and murder. His successor, his son Qi Heidi, was nicknamed the Idiot King for his apparent lack of sense. During his father's funeral, he fell over laughing at the sight of a bald-headed man, but he was sensible enough to tax his people heavily in order to build a beautiful new palace. The taxes were such a burden on the population that it was not uncommon to see travelers weeping over their ruined fortunes as they walked along the road. Finally, Qi Heidi went one step too far when he poisoned an official whom he suspected of plotting against him. This official was the brother of the general Xiaoyan, who had the loyalty of the army. When Xiaoyan heard of the murder, he turned his men out in open rebellion, posting public calls for additional troops. He marched on the southern Qi capital, Nanjing, also known as Jianqing, and laid siege to it for 2 months. At the end of this wretched time, the people of the city, starving and famine-racked, over 80,000 of them dead, stormed the palace and murdered Qi Heidi. They preserved his head in wax so that they could show it to the general when he marched into the city. The southern Qi dynasty had lasted from 479 to 501, barely a single generation. Xiaoyan, now the most powerful man in the kingdom, lingered before taking power himself. For a little over a year, he called himself prime minister and put his energies behind supporting Qi Heidi's 16-year-old brother in his claim to the throne. The southern Chinese kingdom was in the grip of an idea. It needed a hereditary ruler. Unlike Rome, China had never been a place where a general could simply take power because of his strength. He had to fit into the dynastic system, the system that lent to its members a sheen of legitimacy because they belonged to a royal family. Even if that family had just taken power, it still had to define itself as a royal family. Less than a year after the death of the idiot king, the general convinced the teenaged emperor to officially hand power over to him. We do not know what kind of pressure he exerted, but undoubtedly the young man thought that performing a ceremony that officially transferred imperial power to his prime minister would save his life. He was wrong. When the assassins arrived to kill him, they allowed him to drink himself into a stupor before strangling him. They liked him and wanted his death to be an easy one. Xiaoyang took power in 502, under the royal name Liang Wudi, as the first king of a new dynasty. This third southern dynasty, the Southern Liang, would hold power for a little over 50 years, 47 of those under Liang Wudi himself. But it would still identify itself as a dynasty. Liang Wudi transformed his own undistinguished family into royalty, worthy heirs of the dynastic succession of Imperial China. And his strong personality did give the South a temporary anchor. He spent most of his years on the throne trying to rebuild the nation's bureaucracy. He built 5 new Confucian schools for the training of young officials, declared that all heirs to the throne must be fully educated in Confucian ethics, and even instituted a system for peasants and the poor to complain anonymously about the behavior of the rich so that they would not fear reprisals. He also beat off an attack from the Bei Wei and shored up the frontier defenses. He was a Buddhist, and in the years of his reign, his devotion to his faith grew. He sponsored the travels of monks from India so that they could come and preach in the capital city. He built temples. By the end of his reign, there were almost 13,000 within the southern Liang borders. He ordered the gathering of the first Chinese Tripitaka, a comprehensive collection of Buddhist scriptures. He did his best to make sure that Buddhist prohibitions against the taking of life were followed, going so far as to order that all sacrifices demanded by Confucian or Taoist rites be carried out with vegetables and flower cakes, shaped like animals, standing in for the usual sacrificial victims. He was doing his best to undergird his claim to the crown by displaying his virtue. As a southern ruler, he had placed himself in the ancient royal tradition that stretched back for thousands of years, and that royal tradition offered a way to legitimize his grasp for power. Virtuous emperors were heaven-blessed, with divine approval giving them a mandate to rule. Since the very first emperor had ruled in the Yellow River Valley, historians and philosophers had argued that they held power because of their virtue. They were constantly attentive to ritual, Confucius had said, explaining why the first emperors were given the mandate of heaven to rule, exposed error, made humanity their law, and humility their practice. Any who did not abide by these principles were dismissed from their positions. A dynasty could lose the right to rule, the mandate of heaven, if it became tyrannical and corrupt. Liang Wudi's new dynasty would earn the mandate of heaven through displaying its virtue. This strategy proved, in Liang Wudi's case, to have a sting in its tail. As he developed his virtue, he became more and more convinced that Buddhism required him to renounce his ambitions to earthly power. In 527, he took off his royal robes, put on a monk's robe, and entered a monastery, following its rules and disciplines and finding in it, according to his chroniclers, greater joy than he had ever found in his palace. His ministers begged him to come out and take back his crown. His renunciation had apparently not extended to designating an heir, and they were having difficulty running the country without the authority to make royal decrees. The head of the monastery saw a good thing and refused to release the king from his vows until the ministers had paid a huge ransom out of the royal treasury. With the money handed over, he expelled Liang Wudi from the monastery, and the king went reluctantly back to rule the Liang state. To the north, Wei Xuan Wu ruled the Bei Wei from the new capital at Luoyang. His invasion of the south had failed, thanks to Liang Wudi's competent resistance, and although he launched several more attacks, he decided within 5 years that attacking the southern Liang was fruitless. Instead, he concentrated on carrying on his father's campaign to sinicize the northern kingdom into complete Chineseness. But the effort to combine the two worlds of the Bei Wei, the dynamic world of the nomadic soldier and the orderly world of the settled kingdom, now began to bear bitter fruit. In the old nomadic clan system, tribal leaders held more or less equal authority, with one leader granted slightly greater power to oversee the joint efforts of the tribes. The remnants of this system troubled Wei Xuan Wu. He was surrounded by local aristocrats, offspring of the tribal leaders, who claimed the right to control their own portions of land, while collecting taxes from the peasants who lived on this land, taxes that were supposed to be paid over to the royal treasury, and raising armies from the population they governed, armies that were supposed to serve the interest of the royal family. These landowners existed on the thin boundary between two identities, powerful noblemen loyal to the throne and independent petty ruler, and their natural tendency was to lean towards independence. In an effort to corral their power, Wei Xuan Wu continued his father's attempts at land reform. New laws decreed that the land in the Bei Wei kingdom belonged not to individual families or noblemen, but to the government. The government had the right to assign land to individuals who would farm it, support their families with it, and pay taxes from it directly to the throne. When a farmer died, the government could then reassign his land to someone else. This system, called the Junxian, or equal field system, had been used by previous Chinese dynasties farther south, but never by the northern kingdoms. It kept noblemen from collecting more and more land and passing it on to their sons, something that tended to create independent hereditary kingdoms within the Beiwei borders. But it also produced huge resentment from the ex-tribal leaders who saw their traditional power under attack. Furthermore, it deprived those leaders of their private armies. In the old system, they had provided the throne with soldiers, whose first loyalty was to the noblemen who owned their homes, and whose second was to the king. In this new equal field system, soldiers, like families, were given fields of their own, which they farmed in return for serving in the king's army for a certain number of months per year. This broke their tie to the noblemen and reforged it directly to the king. These noblemen were caught in the hard press of transition. Like the king himself, they longed to be Chinese, so even while they resented the decrease of their traditional powers, they found themselves forced to protect their new identity by distancing themselves from their rough warrior past. In the reign of Wei Xuanwu and his successor, this distancing took the form of scorn for the soldiers who were posted on the northern border. The Beiwei kingdom was under constant attack from the nomadic peoples who had not settled into kingdoms, who still roamed in the high grasslands farther to the north. For many years, part of the Beiwei strategy for dealing with these nomads was to capture them and then integrate them into the garrisons posted along the northern frontier, controlling the threat, in essence, by bringing part of it within the Beiwei borders and into the Beiwei army. This meant that the frontiers were primarily barbarian, and that the northern garrisons remained far closer to their nomadic roots than the aristocrats at court. The move of the capital city south to Luoyang had increased the distance between northern soldiers and upwardly mobile noblemen even more. Assignment to fight on the northern frontier, once an honor, became a punishment. Aristocrats were suspicious of the loyalty of the northern garrisons, always ready to see treachery and revolt in the slightest unexpected movement. In 519, one of the noblemen who served at the royal court suggested that soldiers no longer be eligible to hold government offices, a proposal that reflects the growing aristocratic scorn for a part barbarian army. It was the same scorn that had kept the great Roman soldiers Alaric and Stilicho, halfway across the world, from rising to the throne. When word of the proposal got out, the soldiers in Luoyang rioted. Wei Xuanwu had died in 515, leaving his wife the Empress Dowager as regent for his young son Wei Xiaoming, and the Empress quelled the riot by promising that the idea would never be put into practice. But the contempt of the gesture revealed a deep hostility between the border and the court. In 523, the garrisons along the north began to revolt. Fighting between the Beiwei and its own border guard dragged on for several years. The Empress Dowager, who was supposed to be running things in Luoyang, had earned herself the nickname Inattentive Empress for her habit of ignoring anything that was happening outside the city, and the northern rebellions were no exception. Apart from dispatching troops under the guidance of the general Erzu Rong, the Magister Militum of the Beiwei, she did nothing to solve the deep-seated hatred that was ripping the kingdom apart. By 528, she had given her lover most of the power at court while refusing to grant any to the young emperor Wei Xiaoming. Wei Xiaoming, now 18, was old enough to fight back. He sent messages to Erzu Rong, asking him to come back from the northern frontier and remove both the empress and her lover from power. Erzu Rong started south to answer his emperor's plea, but before he could reach Luoyang, the empress dowager poisoned her son. She and her lover then appointed a 2-year-old child to be the figurehead emperor. In response, Erzu Rong and his army declared a cousin of the dead Wei Xiaoming to be the rightful emperor and crowned him in camp on the move. When Erzu Rong arrived at Luoyang, he sacked the city, captured the empress, and had both her and the child emperor drowned in the Yellow River. He then summoned 2,000 of her officials and supporters to his headquarters and had them murdered in an act that became known as the Heiyin Massacre. Worried about Erzu Rong's ambitions, to be the figurehead for an ambitious soldier was not a secure position in either east or west, the new emperor, Wei Xiaozhuang, agreed to marry his daughter, which might keep Erzu Rong from claiming the throne, since his grandchild would theoretically become emperor. But the distrust between the two men deepened. In 530, when Erzu Rong came to the court of Luoyang to wait for his daughter to give birth to her first child, Wei Xiaozhuang had him assassinated. This opened a civil war, with Erzu Rong's relatives and his field army on one side, and the emperor and the army of Luoyang on the other. In 531, Erzu Rong's nephew, Erzu Zhao, captured the emperor in a battle near Luoyang. He broke into the city with his army, sacked it, murdered Wei Xiaozhuang's infant son, and then had the emperor himself strangled. By 534, the ongoing civil war between the dead emperor's clan, the dead general's clan, and their various claimants to the imperial throne had split the Beiwei Empire into two separate kingdoms, the Eastern Wei and the Western Wei. Luoyang, the center of the conflict, was a ghost town, sacked and almost entirely deserted. The strongest general in each faction placed a puppet king on each throne, and the two new kingdoms squared off against each other. Confucian order and Buddhist resignation were a thing of the past. In attempting to make his kingdom Chinese, the emperor Wei Xiaowen had woven into it a thread that, when pulled, ripped the entire construct apart. Chapter 25. Elected Kings. Between 481 and 531, Clovis became the first king of all the Franks. Ambrosius Aurelianus of Britain beats back the Saxons, and the Ostrogoths choose a new king. After the costly defeat of Attila, the Salian Franks had straggled back westward to their lands west of the Rhine. The battle with the Huns had weakened them, but now they regathered their strength. The semi-legendary Merovech died, probably around 457, and was succeeded as chief of the Salian Franks by his son Childeric. But although Childeric claimed the title King of the Franks and established his court at the northern city of Cambrai, he was merely one chief among many. The other Frankish tribes still kept their independence, even while acknowledging the long-haired Salians as leaders of the coalition. There were minor Frankish kings scattered across the landscape, and Roman kings too. After the Romans had given up full control of Gaul, renegade Roman war leaders had set up their own little domains in the land north of the Loire. Childeric was forced to battle against these rival kings, against Odovaker of Italy, against Alemanni invaders to the east, and against Saxon pirates sailing into the Loire. When he died in 481, he was merely chief of the Salians despite his royal title. But he was succeeded by his 15-year-old son, Clovis. At 20, Clovis attacked and defeated a neighboring Roman kingdom and folded its land into his own. This was the first major victory of his reign. Over the next 10 years, he took land from nearby Thuringii, Burgundians, and Alemanni, and his knack for leading the Franks to victory earned him greater and greater authority over the other tribal leaders. He made alliances by marriage as well, contracting a diplomatic match between himself and the daughter of the king of the Germanic tribe of Burgundy. This princess, Clotilde, was a Christian, and the Frankish historian Gregory of Tours tells us that she began to evangelize her husband. "The gods whom you worship are no good," Clotilde insisted. "They haven't even been able to help themselves, let alone others. What have Mars and Mercury ever done for anyone?" It was a pragmatic argument, and in 496, Clovis found it politic to agree with his wife. In Gregory's account, Clovis is on the battlefield, fighting a losing battle against the Alemanni, when he raises his eyes to heaven. "Jesus Christ," he prays, "if you will give me victory over my enemies, I will believe in you. I have called upon my own gods, but, as I see only too clearly, they have no intention of helping me." At once the Alemanni break their ranks and surrender. Clovis returns home a Christian, and he and Clotilde summon the Bishop of Rheims to come and baptize him. For Gregory, Clovis is the Frankish Constantine, and Clovis was indeed following Constantine's lead. Like Alaric's Goths, the Franks were a confederacy, not a nation. They were held together by custom, by geography, and by necessity. They had lived within Roman boundaries for over a century, and their adoption of Roman practices, the worship of Mars and other Roman gods, the Romanized organization of their army, was the strongest bond holding them together. But the Roman Empire had crumbled in the west, and the bond of Romanness was crumbling with it. Like Constantine, Clovis saw that a stronger bond was needed to hold his people together, and to allow him to claim the right of kingship over them all. Christianity would serve as the new glue of the Frankish nation. Gregory insists on Clovis's sincerity. Like some new Constantine, he writes fulsomely, he stepped forward to the baptismal pool, ready to wash away the sores of his old leprosy and to be cleansed in flowing water from the sordid stains which he had borne so long. And then he adds, without a trace of irony, more than 3,000 of his army were baptized at the same time. The mass conversion of the army was the necessary and politic counterpoint to Clovis's own redemption. The Christian royal family and the Christianized army would be the attractive core of a newly united Christian nation of Franks. The benefits of conversion were not long in coming. By 507, Clovis, who had been baptized into Orthodox Christianity, was confident enough to launch a concentrated attack on the Arian Visigoths of Hispania. "I find it hard to go on seeing these Arians occupy a part of Gaul," he told his ministers. "With God's help, let us invade them. When we have beaten them, we will take over their territory." Reinforced by soldiers lent to him by his father-in-law, the King of Burgundy, Clovis marched towards the Loire River and the Visigothic frontier. The armies met at the city of Vuil, in Visigothic territory on the southwestern side of the Loire. The Visigoth king, Alaric II, was killed in battle, and the Visigoth army was scattered. The Franks stormed southward, invading the city of Toulouse itself, and the remnants of the Visigothic court fled into Hispania with Alaric II's 5-year-old son, Amalaric, in tow. This brought the armies of the Italian Ostrogoths into the fight. Theodoric the Great's daughter had been married to Alaric II, so that young Amalaric, possibly the next king of the Visigoths, was a member of the Ostrogothic royal family. Ostrogothic armies arrived at the Rhone River in the south in 508 and forced Clovis to withdraw from the little patch of Gaulish land known as Septimania, right on the coast. But this was a tiny victory. It kept Clovis from establishing himself on the Mediterranean coast, but Toulouse remained in Frankish hands, and Septimania was now the only little patch of Visigothic land in all of Gaul. The Visigoths had been driven almost entirely into Hispania, where they would have to rebuild their shattered kingdom from the ground up. Returning from his victorious campaign with wagon loads of treasure from Toulouse, Clovis paused in the city of Tours to thank God for his victory. There he found a letter from Constantinople waiting for him. The Eastern Roman Emperor wanted to give Clovis, his fellow Christian monarch, an honorary title that would recognize him as a shining light in the barbarian West. Clovis misinterpreted the gesture. He named himself Augustus, Consul of the West, and put on a purple tunic and a diadem. This is undoubtedly not what the Eastern Emperor had in mind, but he did not object. Clovis was far away. His power would check Theodoric the Great of Italy, who was a much greater problem, and there was no harm in letting him wear a purple cloak over there in the shabby little city of Cambrai. Clovis did not remain in Cambrai. Now that he was Augustus, victorious Christian and Roman king, he needed a new capital. He settled on the old Roman town Lutetia Parisiorum on the Seine and began to reinforce its walls. He issued a set of Latin laws for his domain, the Pactus Legis Salicae. The laws were very specific in forbidding old Germanic traditions of blood revenge, instead substituting fines and penalties for clan-based revenge killings. And he killed off the Frankish chiefs who might challenge him for sole power one at a time. From 509 until his death, Clovis ruled from his new capital, Paris, as the first Christian king of the Franks, the first law-giving king of the Franks, the first king of all the Franks. His descendants, taking their name from the legendary warrior Merovech, would occupy the throne for the next 2 centuries as the Merovingian dynasty, the first royal dynasty of the Franks. Across the channel, another king with a Roman past was struggling to save what was left of his native land. His name was Ambrosius Aurelianus, and his origins were obscure and vaguely royal. In 485, just as Clovis was beginning his decade of conquest, Ambrosius Aurelianus led the rulers of Britain in a great battle against the Saxon invaders. For 30 years, the native British had been fighting against this invasion. Keeping the Saxons and Angles away had become a way of life for 2 generations. Vortigern, who had managed to kill one of the original Saxon generals back in 455, had led the resistance for another 15 years before dying, with the enemy still on his doorstep. Later British historians would charge him with all sorts of imaginary crimes, from killing the rightful king of all Britain and taking his place, even though there was nothing close to a rightful king of all Britain in existence in the 5th century, to inviting the Saxons in and handing the country over to them so that he could sleep with the Saxon women. Despite a lifetime of battling the invaders, Vortigern had failed to drive them off, and the bitter memory of his ultimate failure lingered. At Vortigern's death, Ambrosius had taken up the position of chief British warlord. Ambrosius's background is lost. Gildas's history, the oldest account, calls him a Roman gentleman whose parents had worn the purple and had been slaughtered by the invaders. William of Malmesbury refers to him as the sole surviving Roman, while Bede says, mysteriously, that his parents bore a royal and famous name. He also calls Ambrosius a viro modesto, a discreet or reticent man. What we are to make of this is uncertain, but Ambrosius was likely the son of one of the last Roman soldiers left in Britain, perhaps even a descendant of one of the Roman generals who had claimed the title of emperor in the dying days of the Western Empire. Whatever his birth, which he did not trumpet, he had inherited the traditions of the Roman army, and he rallied the petty kings of Britain behind him once more. His initial forays against the Anglo-Saxon invaders were no more successful than Vortigern's. He was badly defeated in 473, and his corps suffered another setback in 477, when yet more Saxon troops landed on the southern coast, near the British fortress of Andarida. They were under the command of a general named Aiella, who claimed the southern land nearby as his own kingdom, the Kingdom of the South Saxons, later shortened to Sussex. He was among the very first Saxons to claim kingship in Britain. The Saxon foothold on Britain was working its way more deeply into the soil. But in 485, the British struck back. On a hilltop known as Mount Badon, perhaps Salisbury Hill in southeast England, although its exact location is unknown, the British under Ambrosius Aurelianus won a great victory over the Saxons. The stories surrounding the Battle of Mount Badon are varied, confused, and filled with later interpolations. Famous names swirl through them. Ambrosius's brother Uther Pendragon fought by his side. Gorlois, Duke of Cornwall, led a wing of the attack. Ambrosius's right-hand general was a soldier named Arthur. Vortigern himself, somehow alive again, joined with the Saxons to fight against his own people. The tales contradict each other, and even the date is not entirely certain. The only constant is British victory. Thousands of Saxons were killed. Hundreds more were driven out of England, back into Gaul and the surrounding areas. A score of legends grew around Aurelianus himself, the last Roman, the last defender of civilization in the face of seemingly unstoppable destruction and death. The victory at Mount Badon did not end the Saxon takeover. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records an ongoing round of battles between the British and the Saxons who remained. In 491, the South Saxon leader Aiella strengthened his grasp on his own kingdom by capturing Andarida, the British fortress meant to guard the southern shore, and massacring all of its inhabitants. There was not even one Briton left there, the chronicle says. For a time, though, the Battle of Mount Badon ended the influx of new armies into the island. For a time, as Irish folklorist Di O'Hogan puts it, the erosion of native Britain was checked. But native Britain was weak, welded together as it was only by the necessity of keeping Saxons out. There was no British kingdom and no British High King, no shared religion, no idea of nationhood. At the beginning of the 6th century, to be British was to be not Saxon, and the independent kings and tribal leaders were jealous of their power, no matter who threatened it. In 511, 26 years after saving Britain, Ambrosius Aurelianus died in battle against another British king, one who previously had been his ally. The battle was at Camlan, near the southwestern coast, and the sword that killed the saviour of Britain was British, not Saxon. Ambrosius became immortal as Arthur, King of the Britons, a man fighting for civilization and order in a world where neither was natural, always threatened by the power of other war leaders, brought down at the end of his life by the treachery of those he should have been able to trust. The mournful declension of the Arthur story, as it was embroidered by the Welsh bard Taliesin, the English historian Geoffrey of Monmouth, the French poet and crusader Robert de Boron, and ultimately by Thomas Malory, is a glimpse into a time when kingship ended with death. In the dark world of the British, as indeed in the world of most Germanic peoples, including the Saxons, the king did not inherit his power. He earned the right to rule through successful leadership of his tribe in battle. His power was given to him by the men who followed him, because he deserved it. When he died, his power died with him, and his followers banded together to recognize another king. For the Romans, as for the Persians, kingship was quite different. In the Roman mind, the king represented something immortal and immutable that went on eternally, outlasting any king who might hold it. The idea of the Roman state. A king could pass the right to represent this idea on to his son, thus the possibility of hereditary kingship. His death did nothing to abridge it. But in Britain, when the king died, his kingdom died with him. The next man to hold the crown recreated it anew. It was a point of view shared by most Germanic peoples, which was why Theodoric the Great had connected the possession of Roman citizenship to loyalty to his own person. Once he had conquered Italy, he was the kingdom of Rome. It is impossible to know whether the old Roman idea of the state had any grasp on the mind of Ambrosius Aurelianus, that British gentleman of undetermined Roman lineage, who may or may not have had a Roman emperor in his family tree. But Geoffrey of Monmouth, looking back from a much different Britain 600 years later, reproduces, perhaps without meaning to, a moment when the death of a king did indeed mean the death of his kingdom. Arthur is mortally wounded on the battlefield of Camlann, but he does not die. He hands his crown to his cousin and is taken away to the Isle of Avalon to be healed. His kingdom survives because he survives, even though he is far away and mysteriously divided from his people. Arthur becomes the idea of the British state in a time when the state and the king were the same. Like the idea of the state itself, he exists eternally. In 511, the same year as the battle at Camlann, King Clovis of the Franks died. He had ruled as sole king of the Frankish state for only 2 years, and did not name an heir to his crown. Instead, he left his kingdom to the joint rule of his four sons, Childebert, Clodomer, Clothar, and Theuderic, not to be confused with Theodoric the Great of Italy. The name, along with its variations, was the Germanic equivalent of the English Henry. Clovis had fought to earn his title, King of all the Franks, and his realm was filled with warlike Franks who still carried with them the old Germanic ideal of kingship, that they had the right to choose their king. They would have bitterly resented any attempt to leave the realm to a single designated heir, one who had not proved himself in battle. Instead, Clovis had left rule of the Franks to his clan, which was quite different, and a much more familiar idea to the Franks, who were accustomed to recognize the leadership of the Salian clan over the others. Each of the four sons chose a different city as the center of his power. The oldest son, Theuderic, went to Rheims. Clodomer claimed Orléans. Childebert stayed in Paris. And the youngest son, Clothar, took Soissons as his capital. In 524, the first crack appeared in the arrangement. When Clodomer was killed on an expedition against the Burgundians, his younger brother Clothar led the other two siblings into Orléans to kill the dead brother's sons before they could lay claim to their father's portion of the crown. The four kings had become three. The old Germanic clan system was inclined to plunge kingdoms into civil war, but it kept incompetent kings out of the throne room. In 531, the young Visigothic king Amalaric, who had come into his majority but had failed to prove himself an effective war leader, was murdered by his own men. They elected a new king in his place, an officer named Theudis, who was not of royal blood, nor was he even a Visigoth. He was from Italy, an Ostrogothic soldier official who had been sent to Hispania some years before by Theodoric the Great of Italy in order to watch over the court while Amalaric was a child. But his blood mattered less than his strength, and he became the new king of the Visigoths. From this point on, ancestry played little part in the selection of Visigothic kings. The nation had reverted to the old Germanic method of choosing their ruler. Chapter 26. Invasion and Eruption. Between 497 and 535, the Hephthalites build a kingdom in North India, and Krakatoa's eruption troubles the world. Buddhaghupta, emperor of the Gupta domain, died in 497, after a 30-year reign. It is unclear exactly who followed him on the throne, but most likely his brother Narasimha took control of the empire, which had shrunk drastically from its height under the great-great-great-uncle Chandragupta II. Tributaries had wandered away, minor kings had asserted their independence, and the Hephthalite trickle down into the north of India had turned into a flood. One Hephthalite warrior emerges from the faceless horde. Toramana, a war leader who conquered his way into northern India between 500 and 510, subduing one petty king after another. By 510, he had pushed his way through the empire all the way to the city of Iran, on the southern edge of the Gupta domain. The governor of this area, Banagupta, was himself of royal blood. Together, he and his general, Goparaja, mounted a great defense against the Hephthalites. It proved fruitless. Goparaja was killed in the fighting, while Banagupta simply disappeared from the historical record. Narasimha's fate is unknown. Toramana claimed Iran for his own, and Gupta power was forced all the way back into its eastern cradle, while Toramana declared himself king. Toramana's original domain lay west of the Indus, in land he kept hold of as he pushed south across the mountains. This gave him an empire that stretched from the eastern borders of Persia down across the mountains into India, breaching the physical border between Central Asia and India. He established his capital city at Sakala, and in a brief time, Sakala grew into a metropolis, a great center of trade. The Questions of King Milinda says that Sakala abounded in parks and gardens and groves and lakes and tanks, a paradise of rivers and mountains and woods. Wise architects have laid it out, and its people know of no oppression, since all their enemies and adversaries have been put down. Brave is its defense, with many and various strong towers and ramparts, with superb gates and entrance archways, and with the royal citadel in its midst, white-walled and deeply moated. Well laid out are its streets, squares, crossroads, and marketplaces, so full is the city of money and of gold and silverware, of copper and stoneware, that it is a very mine of dazzling treasures. And there is laid up there much store of property and corn and things of value in warehouses, foods and drinks of every sort, syrups and sweetmeats of every kind. In wealth and glory, the account concludes, Toramana's city was like the city of the gods. Nevertheless, his empire still had some of the qualities of a nomad's kingdom. In the words of historian Charles Eliot, the Hephthalites overran vast tracts within which they took tribute without establishing any definite constitution or frontiers. Like the Guptas, the Hephthalites did not attempt to enforce laws or tight administrative structures across their domains. A Chinese ambassador who visited Toramana's court remarked that 40 countries paid tribute to the Hephthalite king, but the payment of goods and money was the only sort of dominion that the empire exerted over the people on its edge. Toramana, building up his great capital city, seemed content with this, but when he died sometime between 515 and 520 and was succeeded by his son, Crown Prince Miharakula, the nature of the empire changed. Miharakula was a throwback to his nomadic roots, uncouth, rough-edged, and particularly hostile to the Buddhist faith of his new subjects. The Hephthalites had been converted, some decades earlier, to the Manichaean and Nestorian Christianity that had filtered eastward through Persia towards them. Perhaps because of the fluidity of his borders, Miharakula decided to enforce a new kind of orthodoxy, to get rid of Buddhism. Author's note, as a reminder, Manichaeans tended to see good and evil as equal opposed forces, while Chalcedonian Christianity asserted the omnipotence of the good God and the ultimate subordination of evil. Nestorians believed that Christ had two separate natures, human and divine, while Chalcedonian Christianity argued that the two natures were distinct but mystically combined into one in Jesus, who was thus both God and man indivisibly. Thus, both of the heresies tended towards dualism, while Chalcedonian Christianity tended towards unity. He did not seem to view Hinduism with the same suspicion. In fact, the Indian historian Kalhana, writing 6 centuries later, says that Miharakula's hostility enabled the Hindu Brahmins to gain power in his empire. They accepted grants of land from him, making themselves more powerful than their Buddhist countrymen. But he saw Buddhism as the enemy of his power, most likely because it was the religion of the Guptas. The Emperor Buddhagupta, whose name gives tribute to the Buddha himself, had been followed by equally devout Buddhist emperors, first by his brother Narasimha, and then by Narasimha's son and grandson, each ruling over progressively smaller bits of empire. By the time Miharakula inherited his father's throne, the Gupta dominion had shrunk to the area of Magadha, the Ganges Valley. Nevertheless, the Guptas remained the most powerful opponent on the Indian frontier, and Miharakula set out to destroy their religion. Sometime around 518, a Buddhist mission came to the north of India from China, searching for Buddhist scriptures to collect and preserve. According to their own records, they managed to leave India with 170 volumes. They also met Miharakula and were unimpressed with him. The disposition of this king was cruel and vindictive, their account tells us, and he practiced the most barbarous atrocities. Although the Indians he ruled were primarily Hindu, of the Brahmin caste, they had prized Buddhist teachings until Miharakula came to power and began to destroy Buddhist temples, monasteries, and books. Rather than strengthening his kingdom, Miharakula weakened it. The Guptas, still trying to drive the Hephthalites out, were joined by local rulers who resented Miharakula's high-handed rule. In 528, the governor of Malwa, a province that had first belonged to the Guptas and then had earned independence before falling under the control of the Hephthalite king, won a great battle against Miharakula, so decisively that he was able to drive the enemy back up into the northern reaches of the Punjab. Miharakula lived for another 15 years in his diminished kingdom, but he was never able to return to the northern Indian lands he had once ruled. The Guptas were not able to fill the power void. Monasteries and cities had been destroyed in the Hephthalite Wars. Trade routes had been disrupted. Over the next years, northern India returned to its patchwork condition, filled with little states ruled by independent kings, tribes who migrated from Central Asia into the lands with no king, and small communities formed by farmers and shepherds who came down over the mountains and settled in the plains. These small kingdoms and tribes joined together, when necessary, to drive off any Hephthalite attempts to return, but no strong ruler emerged from these sporadic efforts at defense. In Central and South India, a patchwork of kings continued to rule. We know little of them except what we can glean from inscriptions and coins, names and dates of rule. The Indian kingdoms did not aspire to the universal dominion visualized by the kings of the West, nor did their scholars attempt to write narratives that would tie events together into some sort of huge and meaningful pattern.